So, welcome to a special edition of Life Dunk, and we are very lucky to have in the studio with us today Gidon Lieberman, who is a consultant gynaecologist and a subspecialist in reproductive medicine. Now, he has a very special link with Miriam, and a very special link, which actually he doesn't really know about the link to Wellspring and how it all started. So, Miriam, do you want to talk us through it?
Well, yeah, because I feel I've been quoting you, Gidon, for a number of years, and you probably don't remember the conversation at all, and probably would be surprised to hear that I've been quoting you, because after a number of rounds of IVF, and when I'm still not having a child, I asked you how people stop, like, when do people stop trying for a baby? And first of all, you just sort of flippantly said, oh, well, you know, when you run out of money. And I pushed you and you said something incredibly helpful. You said to me, well, perhaps when the life you're striving for that may or may not happen is making the life you've got more miserable. And those words were incredibly, I mean, they were life changing, because at that moment, what I realized is that the life that we had, this beautiful family of three with one child, was in itself a blessing and a gift. And our toddler was growing up in this life of a roller coaster of emotions and all that kind of comes with IVF. And actually what we needed to be able to do was get to a point where we said, this is our life and here are all the blessings that come with it. Actually, we need to draw a line under what we are trying to achieve. And it was that moment of, well, how do we go about that? How do we stop trying for a child, especially with the background and the backdrop of people saying, well, when you stop trying, that's when you'll get pregnant. But if you have even a little bit of that hope, you've never stopped trying. And how do you actually get off of the roller coaster of trying, but still be living in a loving relationship with one's husband? And that is where this was all born. This, how do we help people draw lines under difficult chapters?
So thank you, Miriam. I mean, this must be quite tough. It must be quite tough for you to bring up stuff. And I suppose when we're talking today, I hope it doesn't upset you. I mean, I just kind of think that's, 'cause I know you're doing the podcast, but you're also a human. So I don't want it to be too...
I mean, what it led to was a sermon in front of 900 people having this conversation with the community of being able to say, this is what Johnny and I have been going through, you know, with a subcategory of, so now you can stop looking at my stomach and wondering whether I'm pregnant or not, because I'm telling you I'm not and I'm not going to be. But using what we ended up doing to be able to draw that line under this, kind of under the IVF journey, to help other people draw that line for themselves. So actually, rather than it being kind of one of those traumatic kind of conversations for me, it's been, you know, I often think I just gave birth to something really different. I expected another child in the other bedroom, but instead what I've been gifted is this kind of whole next chapter of my life, which is, how do we bring Wellspring into the world?
So, Gidon, for you, how is it for you? Do you feel like, how is it confronting, do you see it as a failure, and how is it confronting that, either now in this room with Miriam or in your consulting room?
I try and avoid failure. We were talking before and used the word success. I think it is a success when you have a positive outcome, and I think you should be happy when there's a success, because the parent couple are very happy and they would see that as a success. And I don't think it's good to draw semantics around success. Failure, I think, is a terrible word to use when we talk about fertility, because failure for me means that somebody has they've not passed an exam. That's what failure means to me. Failure means to me something's broken. Something fails, a computer fails. And all of that is very negative. And so for me, when I talk to people about when they haven't been successful with whatever it is, fertility treatment, I say, you've not been successful. That hasn't happened. But I don't talk about failure, because failure to me is so negative. And people have been on through such a long trip, journey, with so much involvement, that when they reach their destination and then they get to their place and somebody says, well, I'm sorry you failed, I think that is very cruel, rather than you've been successful, which just for the act of serendipity is they've got no control over it. So I avoid failure. I talk about people not being successful. And I think it's okay to be successful, but I don't want anybody ever to feel that they've failed, especially the female partner, because no matter how much equality we bring into reproductive healthcare, female partners, they shoulder the burden of that. And so when you tell a woman who really wants to be pregnant more than anything in the world, that they've been through this long journey, had all these this very invasive therapy that they've failed, I think is not good. They've actually succeeded, if you think about it, haven't they?
And do you feel a sense of disappointment personally, or is it just in a day's work? Does it affect you emotionally?
I think the moment it stops hurting a doctor, that's probably when they should stop. I think you feel everybody's unhappiness and pain, and that's okay. You're allowed to feel that. I think where that goes over into altering how you treat somebody medically, which we can talk about, is a different thing. And to hold your nerve and hold the line and be that sort of cold clinical person is very important, because the client is coming to see you to help them have a baby and have a family, and they want that. So I think that's your primary obligation. But secondary, when it's not successful, it's very upsetting.
And how do you help them? Or do you help them? Do you see that as your role?
I do see it as a role. My honest belief is that most doctors aren't very well trained in dealing with it. And I think a lot of empathy and communication skills in medicine is learnt, inherent. I think it's difficult to teach communication skills. Lots of doctors aren't empathetic, whether they should be or not. I think it's difficult, because does that change clinical outcome? Well, it changes the user experience. It changes the client's experience. But does it change the outcome of whether they're going to be successful or not? Not so sure. But, you know, if you're not empathetic and you're not understanding, then this branch of medicine is probably not the one for you.
Miriam, what helped and didn't help you?
In terms of that moving from cycle to cycle.
Yeah.
So I think what's interesting is it's one of the few areas of medicine that you often find out whether it's been successful or not kind of on your own, in your own home, rather than, you know, those people who have had the awful need to go to see an oncologist and to be given results of tests, or waiting for a doctor's call or that appointment to be able to know, well, what's the next step, is really different and very much kind of dictated by the system that holds that transition. Whereas for many women going through fertility treatment, actually, it's the very natural oncoming of the next period that marks that, you know, that end of the month, a not successful round of treatment. And therefore, it's an interesting sense that almost it becomes for the person to reach back out and to say, okay, what now, rather than being kind of delivered the information or being given the results from the medical professional. You know, there are differences. Like, there are times where you're on the phone to the lab hearing about whether you're fertilized egg has multiplied, and that's an interesting relationship in itself. You know, this woman on the end of the phone who works in the lab, who suddenly, you're investing so much in this phone call of, you know, tell me about what essentially is hard not to see as tell me about my baby, you know, how are they doing? It's like the first nursery experience, but it's a Petri dish. And that's a very different conversation to the one that, you know, inevitably happens in your bathroom and happens when you're not going through healthcare, you know, treatment at all, but just trying for a child naturally as well. It's that will it, won't it, has it not happened this month? Which for me is, you know, one of the fundamental practices of mikvah. I think for many women, for generations, a period has been a little bereavement, because if you lived your life in a society where you were either pregnant or trying to get pregnant, and there wasn't a lot of time in between because your role as a woman was to have as many children as possible, actually each period might have felt like a relief of like, maybe I'm getting a little bit longer between one pregnancy and another, or a sadness of it hasn't happened this month. And either way, whether it's the relief or the sadness, that gift of time away from family, away from your partner, in a space that was designed to be used spiritually but on your own, is a psychological gift from the ancient rabbis that I think has been totally misinterpreted over the years and therefore has lost so much of its kind of caring and compassionate qualities.
So tell us, because you, one of your experiences, and I was, as I say, there listening to that sermon, is you talked about your experience of going to a mikveh not in this country and how important it was for you in this journey.
Well, I think, you know, as Gidon alluded to, so much of this is about one's relationship with one's body. You know, it's really difficult not to blame oneself, question, did I do something wrong? What if, you know, a gynecologist I saw before I had was fortunate enough to have met Dr. Lieberman was somebody who, in really one of my first appointments with him, he said the words, well, maybe if you just took a sabbatical from work and took a break, you know, you'd probably just, this would just happen for you naturally. And I didn't punch him, but I did. I didn't go back, because for me, it was that very first thing of like, please don't blame me. And, you know, I wasn't in a job where I was just trying to earn as much money as possible and I was being greedy with my work life. Actually, I was in a role as a community rabbi that I felt incredibly, you know, had an incredible sense of responsibility to. You know, it didn't feel like I could just step away and, you know, have a nice time on the beach and assume that with a long enough holiday, I would get pregnant. So I don't remember where this little bit of the story started, but that piece around not taking blame on oneself and being in relationship positively with one's body was really important.
And how did the mikveh in America help with that?
So actually, we had come to this realization we were going to stop trying for another child, thanks to those powerful words of Gidon's. And one of the ways that we kind of started to do that was we went on a longer a holiday further away than we had been, because you don't plan anything more than a few months ahead when you're going through IVF, because there's always the hope of the what if, right? What if I'm pregnant? What if we've got a toddler? You know, I can't tell a newborn. I can't tell you how many due dates I had in my head that was really just from, like, you know, not even a round of IVF, just like every potential month was a like, well, 9 months from here would be. So the first kind of freeing realization was we could go on holiday. We decided to go to Boston to see some close friends of ours and to be somewhere further away. And Cantor Zoe Jacobs, a very dear friend and colleague, gifted me a voucher to go to Maim Chaim. She'd been very much part of the journey of infertility and kind of dealing with a colleague kind of having these appointments and stuff like that. And knew that what Maim Chaim specialized in as a mikveh was giving people the liturgy to use in the mikveh. So the words to turn a simple immersion in water into a transformatory moment. And it was incredibly powerful. For me, I had done, Johnny and I had done together, a lot of the work of what it meant to be closing this chapter. And so the mikveh was the ritualization of that moment, rather than it doing the kind of hard work that we needed to do for us. But for me, it was very much that powerful sense of what does it mean to reclaim my body, to not be the body that had let me down, but the body that was going to enjoy life, that was going to be there to have fun with my son, that was going to live life to its full. And there's something about that moment of the three immersions. So the being able to look back and having the time to mourn. And, you know, it's interesting we're having this conversation today because a bill in Parliament has just been announced that would give people the right to take leave from a miscarriage before 24 weeks, which for me was kind of one of those. It was interesting because it was not what I did or was asking for. I, you know, threw myself back into work every time immediately. But that sense of what does it mean to acknowledge the bereavements that perhaps I hadn't allowed myself to acknowledge up until then, of the failed or really every month that had been a little bereavement. The being able to look to the future and say, this is what our family can be, of a happy family of three, and to be able to see that positively and to just be in the moment and to say, this is who we are and how lucky am I to have all the gifts that life gives me now, that it's not about looking to the future with hope and striving for something more, but just saying, actually, I've got everything I need in my life right now and I can be grateful for that.
And how does that for you, are there things that you can take from that or you would want to take from that into your clinical
work? Yeah, thanks for sharing that. I think there's a number of aspects. Just come back to where you started from and this concept of, I often talk about resource, and people say to me, well, Gidon, do you think we should have treatment? I'm like, I don't know. I can tell you the chances of it working, but I can't answer that question. And it's often I'll have a conversation about spending that resource, financial, spiritual, psychological, financial, on expanding the family unit or spending it on the family unit that you already have. And I used to think about that a lot and talk about that a lot. But then I thought to myself, well, that's actually a bit of a silly thing to say because you just don't know that. You don't know what that spending is going to mean to somebody. You just don't know what that is going to evolve to mean. And you talked about spending time with your toddler. Now, I've got no doubt that couples who go through IVF, that child, the child in the relationship already, it loses a little bit of mum and it loses a little bit of dad. And finances, well, we can, you know, finances are finances. I think the psychological burden is huge. And I think one thing that I probably want to get across from today, if I can get only one thing across today, is getting rid of guilt. And I talk about emancipation of negativity and emancipation of guilt. Okay, I talk about it, and I use the word emancipation because emancipation is a word we normally associate with slavery. Okay, we don't have a choice; we're beholden to it, and we are kind of beholden to guilt. And women, I think, get it much more than men. Okay, I think women are beholden to the whole guilt, and it may just be, I've done something in my former life. I did this. I shouldn't have shouted at Johnny that day. I had too much coffee. We're beholden to this negativity. And if I can get anything from today, is for people just to sever that link and to say, you know what? I'm not going to lead the rest of my life a slave to that negativity. Because I went through that journey and it could have been positive. could have been successful, but it wasn't for us. And actually, we went through the same journey as everybody else, and it just didn't work for us. And I'm going to free myself from that, because couples who are successful with fertility treatment, they're not beholden to the same negative things that it, we had to go through this journey because of A, B, C, or D. They don't. They just go through the journey and then they move on, and they move on because they had success. So if your treatment hasn't been successful, then free yourself and just move on, because you know you've got, you're going to live longer in this situation than you lived before.
And do you ever tell people or advise people to stop?
Do I ever tell people to stop? I tell people the options. I may tell people to stop. I'm never going to tell people what to do, because that's not my job. Okay, I'm going to tell people what the options are and the chances of this, that, or the other. I will never tell people to. I might advise them that the path that they're on is very unlikely to be to lead to where they want to go.
Right.
And I will let people make up their minds, because my patients are adults and they have the right to make up their own minds about stuff. You know, and it's up to them. I have lots of clients who continue going through multiple rounds of IVF, knowing that it's ultimately unlikely to be successful because the drain on their resource is not significant.
And okay. Is that the major, you mean the financial drain, you mean?
I don't know. You know, I think it's a mishmash of stuff. You put all of that stuff into the bowl and see what comes out. I think a lot of it is financial, but I hear stories of people who've been put into dreadful situations where they have been knowingly or unknowingly exploited by the fertility industry. And I think we all know people where that's happened to. And in a lot of meetings, it's just happened. You know, they just like keep on paying. But sometimes I wonder if people are just, so nobody said, you know, is this really the best thing for you as a family unit?
Do you know then, off your head, obviously, what's the most rounds you've ever known someone go through?
Well, when we talk about rounds, I think when people talk about, oh, I had this many cycles of IVF, and when you dip into the detail about it, it's how many egg collections that they had and how many embryo transfers, and all the words are technical and they get mixed up in people's minds. So a lot of time I'll spend time just trying to pick apart actually what's happened. But multiple cycles of fertility treatment, lots and lots. I think it's interesting because actually it's possible to lose sight of where you want to go. And actually what you're trying to gain from the fertility treatment. And sometimes we come across people who they are a professional patient.
And do you see your role as a doctor as very different, because a lot of doctors, the role is curing. And what you're sort of saying is, it's not, you're not curing, are you? You're maybe giving something, helping someone to achieve something that they want to, but it's not that they're ill if they don't get what they want. Does that make sense?
I understand what you're saying, but subfertility is a disease as defined by the WHO, so it is something that doctors should get involved with. I think it's how you treat the disease is more nuanced, and I think that's what we're talking about.
Right. Go on, tell me a bit more about that nuance.
Well, so if a patient comes to see me and they've got a problem that can be surgically or medically corrected or corrected by fertility treatment, then that's quite straightforward. But if it isn't working, then we have to understand why isn't it working. And then we go down this slippery road of multiple fertility treatments under the premise that it's going to work at some time. Now, I think what's really important, and a medical point I'd probably want to put over today, is that if we're talking about IVF, IVF is a treatment for certain types of disease process. Okay, IVF was never designed for much of the reasons that we use it today. So Louise Brown's mum didn't have any fallopian tubes. Okay, that's why she had IVF. That's why she had IVF. So the sperm and egg couldn't meet. And it's a great treatment for that. When you're trying to overcome a physical barrier in a young woman with normal, when the partner's got normal sperm, it's great. But a lot of what we do in fertility, in fertility treatment is trying to push back the decrease in fertility that we see with increasing chronological female age. So as women getting older, we're saying, well, okay, and there's a decline in fertility, we're going to have IVF. But IVF was never designed for that. IVF can't fix the fundamental and biological changes that happen with age. There is no cure for age. But we present this treatment as a cure for age, where age is affecting fertility. And not surprisingly, it doesn't work.
So it's interesting that Gidon talks about age, because in the Bible, that's quite... fertility and infertility in particular is very present in our foundational stories. And the age factor is quite incredible, isn't it?
Right. Because our matriarchs who are struggling with fertility are incredibly advanced in age. And in fact, you know, coming from a place where we have these incredible stories really begs the question of, is this helpful or not helpful in our narrative? You know, it means the Jewish community are in some way very good at understanding that infertility exists, and we don't always understand why. But it hasn't done two things. So on the one hand, it makes you feel even more of a sense of, but I can take back control. You know, this one of the hardest things I think about infertility is the lack of control. So, you know, I found myself trying to exert that control in two ways, in a religious way, which was, there must be a reason for this. And, you know, when will it be my turn? So we have these different quotes of Adonai Pakad et Sarah, you know, God remembers Sarah and it's her turn now. So, you know, very arrogantly, it's just like, okay, so I'll just wait my turn. And at some point, and in the other way, we kind of, you know, put our doctors on in that pedestal of being able to say, well, we'll give you the control and we'll say to you, do this for us, because the lack of understanding, the lack of control is so difficult, especially when there is no obvious explanation, that it's okay, you know, you've got the answers, you be God at this point and you take on that role. But it's interesting that in a religion that has these narratives that we read again and again every year, it hasn't made our communities places that are more sort of vigilant, comforting, cautious about the area. So, you know, I think as a Jewish community, there's a lot of pressure of, you know, not just one child, but many children. Torah goes straight in. The very first mitzvah of Torah is pru uravu, go forth and multiply. And that sense that that's, you know, just the fundamentals, the basics of doing what we're doing. But I think within tight-knit community, we're very unfair to ourselves and each other. You know, there's so much conversation. I was hyper aware of it in our kind of older generations, you know, the sort of the 60 somethings who, you know, brag about the number of grandchildren they have as a sort of badge of honor, in a way that I don't think people really understand who they're talking to and how difficult that can be, and what it means to say to somebody who, you know, has not been made a grandparent, what it means to identify yourself and use your own grandchildren as your way of kind of defining yourself. You know, you wouldn't get a sort of, you don't get someone going, well, I earn X amount every year, and that being their like opening gambit status kind of, well, they might want to, but, you know, they tend not to, in the way that we sort of define ourselves in that. So I think you get these pressures of kind of yourself, the pressure you're putting on yourself and your partner of like, this is what we want, the wider family of, what does it mean to, you know, have not given my dad as many grandchildren as his other children have given him, of the wider community of, what does that mean of not kind of upping the birth rates in the Jewish community because it's who we are. And then this like ultimate thing of the divine commandment of, you know, what does it mean to be the person who hasn't passed on their Judaism in the same way as others.
And how do you feel about being compared to God there, Gideon? I mean, I'm going to say it facetiously, but I actually mean it.
Can I come back with a joke?
Yeah, of course.
What's the difference? This is a doctor's joke. It says, what is the difference between God and a surgeon? And the answer is, God knows he's not a surgeon. And I think that this putting people out, can I rephrase that? Putting your doctor on a mantle? I probably would rephrase it that way. I think it happens. And I think if you're involved in life, the creation of life, then I can see, it's obvious how, you know, to do the steps. And just a couple of points there, just picking up on what I said before about the empathy about, you know, doctors have, I'm wanting to do everything. And what that leads to, so Miriam might say, Gideon, why didn't it work? And I'll say, well, I don't know. It's just biology. And I went to a fascinating talk a number of years ago about quantum energy, and actually the quantum energy and the waves that are involved at the moment, the specific moment of fertilization, and the energies that are involved, the quantum energies that are involved in the fusion of sperm and egg, and actually what happens on a quantum level. Is that God? I don't know. But I can't affect that. I can't give a supplement saying I'm going to affect your quantum energy. But what people read is this vitamin, that vitamin, and that's fair enough. And then they'll say, was there anything else? And there, if we Google now reasons for unexplained subfertility, we'll find a million things. And I think then what happens is people, the doctor who's probably nice, wants to help, and says, well, have you thought about this? And then there's this litany of additional therapies that aren't. And you have to be brave and say, that's not going to help. That's not going to help. And then somebody says, well, my cousin twice removed had this done and it worked. And then you're like, and you can see how that goes on. And I think it's an issue. I'm going to just come back to what you were talking about, fertility in the community. And subfertility is when you can still get pregnant. Infertility is absolute. So okay. A woman who's gone through menopause, or a man who's got no sperm, it's absolute. So I think we're talking about subfertility and infertility today. And I think something that I see a lot, and I think more and more about actually as I get older, is how couples without children, women without children, are ostracized. And I see this in different strengths, flavors, and different parts of the Jewish community. But there is no doubt that there's people are ostracized. And unknowingly, women, people without children, don't get invited to children's parties.
Yeah.
They just don't. And then it goes on and on. And a lot of our friends, probably we know through our children's friends in a
right. Well, it starts with your NCT group, yeah. And then the parents you're picking up from the school gates, and so friendships evolve and maybe evolve away from the friendships of your own childhood, that people get left behind if they're not, their friendships are not also evolving because they haven't had kids.
Absolutely. So the people are ostracized, and it's terrible because these people often aren't there. Involuntarily childless people are there. They don't want to be there. You know, they want to be involved. And it's, I'm not going to say that you should invite people or shouldn't invite. I'm not going to go down that road. But what I'm saying is there is, they are ostracized. I think what's more, not more, but very interesting, and this is becoming much bit more spoken about in the fertility world paradigm. There's two things going on. There's the falling fertility rate in the Western world and why that happens, or in the entire world, and why that happens, but also the association of childlessness and disease and death later in life. Because men, I don't know if you know this, but men who don't have children, for whatever reason, they die 15 years earlier.
And women who don't have children statistically live longer and have better mental health, which is something that also isn't talked about, as we want to keep that quiet. It's better for women to stay single. I just on the point, and
she's just hoping her husband doesn't hear this podcast or her children.
Or my children, yes, that's right. Yeah. But actually, in all seriousness, to sort of end, there is a thing that the Jewish community can do, and what Gideon says, in terms of community being more than just family, and that actually coming to a religious community can give you access to children, and if it's done well, plug you in to other people with children and not stratifying it, that these are just children's services and these are, if that works well, do you think that actually that's something that can...
Absolutely. I think, you know, one of the things that community does for us is give us extended family in all sorts of ways. So it gives our children the aunts and uncles and grandparents that, you know, in a very different way, in a huge way of people that they're, who are also watching them grow up, but also puts people in relationship with each other that outside of the synagogue community or outside of the Jewish community, they might not have those interactions and that kind of regular check-in and that regular ability to see each other. So anything that community can do to enhance those relationships rather than go back down the sort of societal routes of going, well, we'll keep carving people up according to their age or stage of life, but rather bringing people together is really beautiful. But I think also that thing of, you know, we talk about le dor vador, passing things from generation to generation in the Jewish community a lot, and the concept of legacy, and really being able to understand that legacy is not always a genetic one. It's not always about what we have passed on to our own children, but we can see our legacy very strongly within community, often in a way that it's sometimes much harder to have recognized in a working world, or you seem to need a sort of a level of success to really understand one's legacy in a way that actually I think community highlights very beautifully in a different way.
And do you see, when you think about your legacy as a human being, do you see it as the children, the babies that you've created, or do you think about your is that part of it, or do you think much more individually about your family and what you've?
I don't even think about it like I mean, I do think about it like that. I do. I'm really happy and proud, and people say, "Oh well, you know, baby, whatever is now doing this and that," and I'm really pleased for them. I think it's. I just talk to people about doing the small things and being happy with the small things, and it comes back to what we were talking about at the beginning about success and failure. And actually, if you've helped people on the journey a little bit, and if you've helped somebody a little bit today, then that's kind of all you can do, because the greater is made up of little bits of good. And I kind of think. I'm obviously pleased when I see a little baby or a family, and I love to get a little card now and again. In a lot of ways, I get a lot of happiness, more happiness from people say, well, it didn't work out for us, but, you know, and this is an important point, and actually, but that difficult time in our lives wasn't as awful as it might have been. So I think that, I mean, I can't say that for everybody. I'm sure I've upset lots of people, but actually trying to do little bits of good is all that one can aim for, maybe.
That's a nice way to end, Miriam. Do you want to just end with that?
Absolutely. You know, for me, I think the gift of those words of being happy with the life you've got, not at the expense of the life you're trying to gain, are actually words that have been a true gift to me, and one that I hope will continue to go on and inspire and help many, many other people through the creation of Wellspring. That ability to be able to help people see the blessings in their life, even when life is not in any way how they would have chosen it. And I recognize there's always the caveat of, you know, when you're already blessed with one child, for some people talking about fertility issues in this way will feel like a real kick in the teeth for those that haven't got children and would have only ever recognized one child as a blessing. But I think it's that ability to see that whatever adversity that we encounter in our lives, being able to say, where am I now? And how does that adversity walk alongside me and not necessarily define me, but actually accompany me in the choices that I make further down the line.
Lovely. Thank you very much indeed, both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gidonna. Thank you, Miriam.
Thank you.